Welcome to Fear-Free Childbirth Podcast with Alexia Leachman, the weekly nine-month podcast to help parents-to-be look forward to their fear-free childbirth. Alexia is a pregnancy and head trash clearance coach and the author of Fear-Free Childbirth, How to Have a Stress-Free Pregnancy and a Positive, Pain-Free Birth. As a mum who's had two fear-free and pain-free births, Alexia wants to share with you how she overcame her pregnancy and childbirth fears, so that you can look forward to having a fear-free birth too. Over the nine-month life of this podcast, Alexia will be sharing some real-life stories from mums and dads, insights into the latest childbirth research, inspiring tales from birth professionals, and some tips and techniques for clearing your fears and stresses. If you would like to receive a free chapter from her book, then head over to fearfreechildbirth.com, where you can also sign up for her email series, How to Have a Stress-Free Pregnancy. But now, it's time for the show.
Hello and welcome back to the Fear Free Childbirth Podcast. This is me, your host, Alexia Leachman. Thank you so much for joining me today. Now, on today's podcast, I'm taking a slightly different angle than I usually do. Today, we're going to be taking a look at things from the bloke's perspective. Now, let's be clear, your guy is going to be a really important person at the birth. He's going to be your rock and you need him to be that. And that is exactly what he wants to be. He wants to support you and baby so that the birth outcome is as positive and as wonderful as possible. So in today's show, I want to help you to understand what it's like from the guy's perspective, but also helping him to understand what he can do to help support you. And to help me to do that, I'm going to be speaking to Mark Harris. Mark Harris is a midwife here in the UK, and he's also the founder of Birthing for Blokes. And you can find him on Twitter and Facebook if you just search Birthing for Blokes. Now, Mark is going to share a ton of really useful and insightful information to help you to better understand what's going on for the guys, but also for the guys to understand what's going on for us. So this is a really great episode for both of you to listen to, because there's once you have more of an understanding of how we differ during the birthing process, but what roles our hormones are playing and how they play together and create the experiences that we're having, it can give you such a much more of an understanding of what's going on in the birthing process, but also in terms of helping you to improve the way that you relate to each other generally and your relationship. So the stuff that Mark's going to be sharing with us during today's chat just goes beyond the birth, to be honest. It goes well into the relationship, and it's all just so interesting. So some things we touch on is the hormonal differences that exist between men and women, but also some of the things that guys can do as well to prepare for the birth. And there's some really, really lovely ideas in here as well. So there's just so much juicy, great stuff that Mark's going to share with us. So here is the time that I spoke to Mark Harris all about how guys can help to prepare for a positive birthing experience. Well, welcome to the Fear-Free Childbirth Podcast, Mark.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Mark, before we dive in, because we've got such a fascinating subject we're going to talk about today, but before we dive in, would you mind just telling the listeners a little bit about how you came to do what you do?
All right. I can't really separate it from my life in general, obviously. And I was married for 22 years and had five children. They were all under eight at one time, which was a challenge. None of them went to school either, you know. All of my children were homeschooled.
Wow.
And life was good. I'd started as a midwife in 1994. I trained as a general nurse in 1988. And certainly in the UK, back when I trained in 94, there were 38,000 midwives and there were 61 men.
Incredible.
In fact, it had only been legal since 1976.
Really?
European law changed that made it illegal to prohibit men going into that area. And do you know, as we speak now, there's around about 91 men out of 38,000 plus midwives. So it hasn't really been a growth area.
Is that globally or the UK?
No, that's the UK. Forgive me.
So 38,000 midwives?
About that. And 91 of us are men.
Goodness.
I don't know about the American context. I'm guessing there are fewer male midwives there because midwifery is kind of structured very different in the States, isn't it? So I'm married for 22 years, working as a midwife, done various things in life. I worked as a teacher in further education, a youth worker. Midwifery has always been active in my life. I was probably working full-time as a midwife for about 15 years. And then my wife got cancer when she was 35.
Goodness.
And that came back 6 years ago, and sadly she died. At the time, I had these five children. And, you know, I don't want to sound cheesy, but it kind of woke me up.
Yeah.
You know, when my wife died in my arms, and as she died in my arms in my front room, I kind of knew that life was not going to be better when.
Mm.
You know, because I had a massive investment in the future being great.
Mm.
And I realized that was a hallucination. And that life was never going to be better when, because this is it.
Mm.
The moment I'm in is the only moment I have. And that sent me on a bit of an existential journey, I guess, to answer the questions, how do I want to be in the world in the moments that I have? Because, you know, life only ever turns up in this moment.
Mm.
And I look back over my career and realized that the passion generated through being involved with the birth of a new family was something that I hadn't really got close to in any other discipline or any other work I'd done. So I threw myself into it with a vengeance, really. Yeah, that's my story. And of course, being in a birth context with a couple predominantly, as a man, you begin to see the impact that environment is having on him.
Mm.
You know, all same-sex partners for that matter. And you begin to see how the environment, certainly in the UK, is not set up to actually even regard his fears and the stuff that he's going through. So Birthing for Blokes was born. I was lucky enough to meet another woman. I had a bucket list after my wife died, and on it was an acting workshop.
Oh.
And I did an acting workshop out of the blue at 46, just to do the workshop. And I got called 3 weeks later, and I got cast in a little theatre play called Shadowlands. And I played Professor Riley.
Oh, fantastic.
It was fabulous. And I met my girlfriend while I was kind of reading my lines in a pub.
Oh, fantastic.
And we've gone on to adopt a little boy. So I have a six-year-old little boy who we fostered for 3 years and have now adopted. So...
Well, already I've got so many questions for you. But the first one I'm going to ask you is, what drew you to become a midwife?
Well, good point. You know, I went into nursing because I think I had a foretaste of that stuff I was talking about, making a difference.
Mm.
You know, I realised that I could maybe earn loads of money doing other things. I'd had a little foray into selling and stuff like that. And I was kind of naturally quite personable. But I didn't want to spend my life accumulating stuff.
Mm.
I wanted to make some kind of difference. And I went into nursing because I thought, well, that would be great, you know, caring for people. And I did register general nurse training. I got kicked out of school, by the way. I managed to get into nursing through doing an entrance test. And... when I qualified, suddenly I was being asked to pursue non-patient-centred activity.
Mm.
And I really didn't want to do it. You know, the whole washing people and caring for people was at the core of why I started. And suddenly I had to manage resources.
Mm.
And a buddy of mine, Dave Smith, was the first ever male midwife in Warwickshire. And he said, look, I'm loving this. I'm with the people I'm meant to be caring for most of the time, if not all the time. Give it a go. So I did. And I was hooked. I went on to meet my very best friend, Dennis Walsh, who lives in the same city. He's a professor of midwifery in Nottingham. And we've known each other 20 years plus. And the movement into midwifery was probably the best career move I ever made, really.
So you've been practicing midwives what, since the mid-90s. So tell me about the birth of Birthing for Blokes. How did that come about?
Well, like I said, when my wife died, I wanted to go back to that time in my life when, which is really interesting in and of itself, the way I said that, because obviously there's no going back. There's only a recreation of the memories that you have in the moment you're in, and they either generate energy or they generate a story that leaves you unhappy. But I recognised that passion generation came in the context of midwifery, and I realised that I had a unique set of skills and experiences, being one of quite a small group of midwives. And I was lying talking to my girlfriend about how I recreate my future, because I really decided I didn't want to work for anyone either. Mm. I wanted to do my own thing. And we were bantering about it. And I said, well, I'd like to do birth education, but maybe I want to be the reinvention of birth education for men and same-sex partners worldwide. I'd like to be the creator of something that would serve that population. And she said, well, why don't you start something called Birthing for Blokes? And that was how it started. And that was 3 years ago now.
So for those people that aren't familiar with Birthing for Blokes, would you mind just sort of telling us a little bit more about it?
Yeah. Well, we're on Twitter at Birthing for Blokes and on Facebook, obviously. It's really a recognition that in the same way that women birth from an ancient primeval history of birthing excellence. You know, when I start a group of couples classes, I'll always say, you know, you come from you are the pinnacle of evolutionary development when it comes to birth. You are amazingly equipped and prepared to give birth. And someone will say, well, how do you know that? Well, I say, well, if you weren't, you wouldn't be here. You know, evolution works in a way that is no respecter of persons. You know, we come from, if you're counting when we became biped, you know, on two legs, that's 200,000 years ago. So you're in a line of 200,000 years of women that birth well.
Yeah.
And if you count mammalian history, you have millions of years of developmental excluding those in the line that don't birth well, to the point where we get to the pinnacle of birthing history. And you're it. You're it. So as a midwife, I'd often use that kind of language to talk about a woman's hormonal response to birth. You know, we know that when a woman's birthing, she releases high levels of oxytocin, which are responsible for keeping the birthing process moving along. And there are certain things in an environment that will have an impact on oxytocin release. That they're the kind of things that stimulate neuroadrenaline, you know, adrenaline.
Yeah.
So bright lights, the lack of privacy, asking a question that demands an answer, not talking generally, but asking a question that demands an answer. Those things will cause the release of adrenaline, which will inhibit oxytocin and which will impede the birth process. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because that's obviously the product of evolutionary adaptation. But what about him? He must also have the same adaptations, particularly crafted for him to be of use when it comes to her birthing.
Mm.
So, well, we know he has a fight or flight response. We know that part of his brain, which is mammalian, you know, that deep part of the brain, which is millions of years old, which responds intuitively to threats to our kind of safety and well-being. How is that working for him? And so Birthing for Blokes explores that endocrine dance, you know, the hormonal dance, and it offers him an opportunity to work with that leading up to the birth and after.
So basically, when we're looking at a typical birthing scenario where the woman is going to need to have certain environmental factors in place to promote the hormones that are going to help her through birth, but they're not necessarily going to be the same factors that are going to help the guy go through birth. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Poles apart. So we know, let's imagine prehistory. They're on the savannah, or the plain, the Rift Valley, and she's in the early stages of the birthing process, and suddenly she's attacked. Mm. All right, well, what happens is that the adrenaline causes oxytocin to be inhibited. The birthing process goes off or settles down so that she can escape. If she's attacked in the later stages of the birthing process, around about what's called the second stage, the expulsive phase, the release of adrenaline into her system then causes her to give birth to the baby so that she can hopefully pick the baby up and then escape. So that's how it's worked for thousands of years. Now, he has almost certainly had the responsibility of keeping her safe from feelings of fear in the early stages of the birthing process. Mm. And certainly until the early 70s, he did that from outside the birthing room. Around about the mid-70s, according to Michelle O'Donn, men started to come into the birthing room, and he says it was probably due to the fact that our communities were shrinking, extended family was reducing in terms of its ability to support the new couple, and birth became industrialised, certainly in the UK. We moved from home birth being popular around about 1971 to a situation where almost every woman went into her hospital, and those hospitals were usually large and were usually based on almost a semi-industrial model. Mm. That people had to get through the system in a set time.
Yeah.
I often say, we made up the whole idea of the stages of birth, or labour, as other people like to refer to it. So we made up those stages and then forgot that we did. So we made up measurement and then forgot that we made it up. And suddenly we become fixated on, where am I in this birthing process? How can I measure it? So when the man got in the room, he then had to have a function when he got into that room. And he had to manage these fight or flight hormones that were going on in his body in such a way that he was useful. And I would say, in the years since he's been in the birth room, we as birth professionals have not done a very good job at preparing him for it.
So in the birthing environment, are you saying there are certain things that men can maybe learn about or find out beforehand that can help them to manage their own hormonal response, which in turn can help them to support their partner?
Yeah, without a doubt. And in my experience, it's best to be preparing before the birth, as early as you can.
Okay.
As early as you can in her pregnancy to start preparing. And, God, there's so much to talk about. There's so much I want to say that presumes that I've said something else.
Well, I'm just thinking now, there's probably women listening to this going, my goodness, I need to go get my guy. He's got to listen to this.
Well, so, most of the men that come to my sessions have been sent by their partners.
I can imagine they have.
Without a doubt.
So when you say we need to start preparing as soon as possible, I think women need to as well, though, to be honest.
No, that's absolutely true. And I'm not negating that. It's just that my mission, if you like, is preparing men and same-sex partners that are there supporting their partners. I think they've been neglected over the years by birth professionals.
Yeah.
I mean, even when it comes to breastfeeding, for example, there's research now that says when men are involved with the education process around breastfeeding, the longevity rates of breastfeeding are significantly increased.
Mm.
Significantly increased. Australian research and Brighton research that shows that. Now, that's a public health issue.
Mm.
Breastfeeding rates have been poor for a long time in terms of longevity. But that's another subject, Lex.
Yeah. So back to...
Yeah, let me... The stuff that I teach to men really has an impact on relationships generally.
Okay.
When applied in the context of birth, it supercharges their preparation.
Yeah.
It doesn't diminish the importance of knowing the facts about what's going to go on in birth, because I can talk about that until the cows come home. But it's not the primary focus of the stuff that I teach in the beginning.
Mm.
So, for example, me and you both have the same set of hormones in our body, but they interact with each other in different ways. And this applies to probably 90% of the male and female population. I do get concerned sometimes that it sounds like a stereotype. And of course, these understandings about the endocrine system and how the hormones work are rooted in evolutionary biology. So, you know, we want to apply meaning to it, and we end up saying, my mate Dennis Walsh, when I tell him about this, he says, yeah, Mark, but be careful, this stuff can be used in a patriarchal way to oppress women. And I say, yeah, it can, but these findings can be tested in our experience. I mean, let me tell you a little bit. So, for example, when I have high levels of testosterone in my body, that actually has a stress-reducing impact on me as a man. So, for example, if I pursue a purpose or a goal, that will raise testosterone in me and will have a stress-reducing impact on me. When I pursue any activity that has any element of risk in it, that will raise testosterone and reduce anxiety in me. There's been studies done amongst men that are depressed, and they universally have low levels of testosterone. Now, a woman, 90% of women, not wanting to stereotype, but this is an endocrine phenomena, nothing more. When testosterone rises in a woman, it inhibits oxytocin and estrogen. And oxytocin and estrogen are central to a woman's ability to experience a relief of stress. The kind of activity that stimulates oxytocin is nurturing activity, creativity, touch, massage, listening to music, walking with nowhere to go.
Connection.
Yeah. Dare I say shopping? Connection. talking to friends. All right, now this is rooted in the structures of the brain as well. You know, the two hemispheres of the brain, a woman has at least eight connections between the two hemispheres of the brain in the corpus callosum. That's the bit in between. So she's got loads of capacity for making connections across the two hemispheres. Bloke has two connections, all right? So now if you think back to when we were hunter-gatherers and the kind of distribution of roles in that society where survival was the key, a man of the species, a male of the species, would have been hunting. So there are certain skills that would have evolved in his neurophysiology that would have made him successful at that. And only the good ones would have survived. So proprioception, the ability to see in peripheral vision, neuroscience is now telling us that men do have a higher capacity for that than women. The ability to sift information and come to a conclusion quickly in terms of focus. Now, it sounds so stereotypical, Lex, but I'm going to risk it. But see, that would have served him when survival was of necessity. And likewise, the female of the species would have had different roles. Now, there was a Guardian article recently that suggested that anthropologists studying hunter-gatherer communities found that there was an egalitarianness in the social structure. So there was no hierarchy. There was just necessity of function. And they suggest that prior to human beings growing crops, that there was no paternalism. There was no male dominance. It was just a society based on functions that were necessary in order to survive. But when it gets down to the nitty-gritty of relationships and birth, you know, I talk to men and we'll chat about our experiences with the women we love, and they all tell me that when they're sitting down to listen to their partner talk, the partner, and my girlfriend, right, she'll tell me something, she'll tell me it again, and while she's talking, she'll be going around the subject. She isn't coming to a conclusion, she's not telling me about what she's doing, she's making lots and lots of connections as she talks. She has more capacity for that. Until I knew this stuff, I'd sit there, and after about 5 minutes, I think, yeah, got that, and this is what I think we should do. That's the conclusion I've jumped to. Now, before I knew better, I would just interrupt and say, yeah, I get it, you've told me that twice, this is what I think we should do. Now my mission is to listen until she's finished. You see, now I get it as a mission. That releases testosterone in me and relieves my stress because I understand what's going on. So, and as I listen to her, that releases oxytocin in her and relieves her stress.
I see.
So just the understanding of that starts to revolutionise relating one to another.
So just let me just get that again. So basically, by what's the mind shift that you took on then? You say since your mission has been more about understanding the how the hormones are affecting us differently, that has enabled you to become a better listener and has improved your relationship. Is that what?
Not just better listener. The focus of my listening has shifted from fixing.
Yeah.
Because of course, fixing would have in the past released high levels of testosterone and relieve my stress. You know, as my girlfriend might talk about things that she perceives as a problem.
Yeah.
Right. My anxiety level would go up. I would come up with a fix, and that would relieve my anxiety slightly.
Okay.
All right. Now I realise my mission in this situation is to listen until she's finished. So now, because I'm mission focused, my testosterone goes up and relieves my stress. You know, I have women speak to me and they say, you know, when I first met him, we would talk for hours and he would listen for hours and it's fabulous. But now, you know, I struggle to get him to listen for 3 minutes. She says, why is that? I say, because when he first met you, he was on a mission. Do you see that? It's so clear.
It's very clear.
You know, if we're going to talk about sex, for example, so Michelle O'Donnell says that orgasm, female orgasm and birth are one event separated by time.
Mm.
The hormonal family responsible for female orgasm is the same hormonal family responsible for great birth. So one of the things I'll talk to men is an environment suitable for birth is much the same as the one that you feel should orgasm freely in. So straight away, that raises some issues about hospital birth.
Yeah.
That you have to be proactive about. The hormonal dance of orgasm is fascinating. So when a woman orgasms, she releases lots of oxytocin in her body. Now, if she's lucky, right, to orgasm. Of course, in order to feel like sex in the first place, her oxytocin levels need to be raised. You know, and a man can have an influence upon raising oxytocin levels in his actions towards her. Listening is one of those actions. So she releases this oxytocin. She feels full of life. She may well want to talk. She certainly wants to connect, right?
Mm.
And she might want to do it again. So a man, when he orgasms, he releases oxytocin too. But the oxytocin in him inhibits testosterone and stimulates estrogen. The inhibition of testosterone and the release of oxytocin and estrogen makes him sleepy.
I see.
So, you know, I mean, I can't tell you the amount of times I've been, you know, that we've had this discussion with couples, you know. He just wants to sleep.
Yeah.
I want to connect. You know, when he's thinking of sex, often it's very process and outcome driven.
Mm.
And it's very easy to get an outcome when you're a bloke
yeah.
in that context.
Yeah.
So I find that these kinds of understandings, when introduced to a man, start to revolutionise how he relates to his partner, because his mission becomes raising oxytocin levels in her.
Mm.
So, you know, before I'd say, buy her something. He said, I did that already. That's not the point. You know, when you buy her something once, that's one. Dr. Gray, John Gray, speaks about gaining oxytocin points.
Yeah.
And he'll say, you know, when you buy her something, that's one oxytocin point at that point in time.
Yeah.
And so listening is raising her oxytocin, massaging her, raising her oxytocin. And within Birthing for Blokes, we have overt homework and covert homework. So go home in between sessions. One of the homeworks is, if your partner likes music, compile a playlist together that you like to slow dance to. So having compiled it, dance to it for 15 minutes once a week. When the birthing process starts, you already have an anchor to great feelings that are going to release oxytocin in her. You dance to the playlist through the birthing process.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, it's cool. Another one is massage. So, and I don't know how, you'll have to edit this if it's too racy, but so massage in the early weeks of pregnancy, at least once a week, a massage. As you get to about 35 weeks, the massage has the potential to become sensual with a view to her orgasming, and the bloke is encouraged not to fulfill himself sexually in that context. So those things are all designed to raise oxytocin in her, to have a habit in him of seeing raising oxytocin in her as his mission. Mm. And as he moves into the actual birthing process itself, his mission is connection, primarily to her and secondarily to the midwife, because the midwife is oxytocin depleted as well. So her access to her compassion and love is being inhibited by the fact she's in a structure that's ridden with testosterone.
I see. So the father's got a role to keep oxytocin flowing in both of the...
Well, it's primarily her, his lover. So primarily when he senses any sense of disconnection, his goal is to get it back. Whether that's kind, loving words of connection, not questions, God no, but kind, loving words of connections or massage, or, you know, invoking the playlist, or anything he can do to maintain connection. And he'll know when he's not got it, because he'd have been practicing maintaining it over the 9 months that she's been pregnant. If he has capacity, and he notices that the midwife is in stress response, when I encourage him to reach out with kindness to her. Mm-hmm. In fact, I encourage couples to put together an oxytocin building box, a gift for the midwife. So in that box are the kind of things that his lover would imagine, if given to her, would raise her testosterone levels. So in that box might be hand cream for the midwife, might be chocolate, you know, just little gifts that they can just give to the midwife throughout the process to
help
with
her,
the aim of stimulating her oxytocin. Mm. Kindness is the big one, you know, just not being an arsehole.
Yeah.
You know, because when blokes don't know this stuff, there tends to be polarized responses. So the guy gets this massive rush of adrenaline. He wants to protect his lover. He feels like he can't do anything because he doesn't know anything. So he'll either, and these are poles, okay, so there's an analog in between. So he'll either get really aggressive, bolshy, and act like an arsehole, or he'll lose himself in his paper, or he'll be overly funny, because he can't control the rush of emotions, and that's what he's always done when he's felt this way. And giving a man an option to explore this kind of purpose in the birth room, and in relationship, and in fatherhood, for that matter, relieves his stress and gives him purpose in the birth room.
So some of those responses that you just cited sound like they could be also coming from a place of fear of
They totally are, and they're beyond conscious control. Mm. Actually, I mean, although we do breathing exercises, I teach men some breathing exercises, some centering exercises. We explore the nature of meaning making as human beings, and all of that stuff. Mm. But in that moment, if he isn't clearly focused on his purpose of maintaining connection, he will be lost to that reaction. That reaction is what's kept us surviving. You know, that reptilian part of the brain is responsible for the four Fs. You might have to cut this, but, you know, fight, flight, freeze, and reproduction.
Yeah. So we've talked about the hormonal, the inducting dance that you've called it.
Yeah.
But just touching back on the fears and how, you know, this comes mainly about the male response, is it's typically because they have got a bunch of fears. So what kind of, you know, for the women listening are thinking, well, what kind of fears has my guy got? What kind of fears do you come across in men when it comes to that birth?
Yeah, the main one, I'd say top of the list, bar none, is most men, when they think about birth, are afraid of risks to the baby and to the mother.
Right.
So they're concerned about the lives of, you know, of their progeny.
Yeah.
Which again is so evolutionary written into us. Mm. You know, it's at the source of most of male jealousy. You know, it's the idea that this our progeny goes on. And from obviously an evolutionary point of view, that makes absolute sense. Mm. So it's this visceral fear of mother and baby dying.
Okay.
And so he is very risk focused. Which is why the majority of men in the UK, when asked about home birth, say, no, far too risky, you know, even though the data suggests otherwise.
Is it also the home birth angle, is that maybe they think that if anything happens, it comes to them to sort it out, whereas in a hospital they feel safer because there's backup?
Absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of backup type stuff that comes out when you talk to men about this. You know, there's a neonatal unit there, and what do I do, and all this kind of stuff. And they're valid questions, which I spend a lot of time talking about. See, the other thing, an appeal to man in terms of education is different to women. By and large, given this endocrine dance, a man will respond very well to challenge, whereas a woman won't respond so well to challenge, and more to appreciation and I'm saying the word praise, but that sounds so patronising. But acknowledgement, you know, a woman responds better to acknowledgement and that kind of approach. So, in the context of an all male group, you know, there's quite a lot of challenge in the context of how the information is given. And I also spend a lot of time talking about the science, so-called, the evidence, so-called, and making it very clear that they've pretty much been sold a bit of a lie when it comes to safety and all that stuff.
So just expand on that a little bit then.
Okay, well, I'll give you the birthplace study in the UK that was released late last year. Probably the most important piece of evidence around place of birth since the Peel Report in 1971. And that's not me talking, that's Dennis Walsh, who's Doctor of Midwifery, and his speciality is place of birth.
Okay.
So he's a world authority on this. And having read that study, he said it's really significant. He said for the first time, what's happening is women are not just being told that home and midwifery-led units are as safe as doctor-managed hospitals. They're actually more safe, safer, if you factor in the fact that you won't get as many interventions that are potentially unnecessary, like episiotomies, ARMs, you know, cut is the episiotomy, perineum. ARM is breaking the sac of fluid that the baby's in before it breaks spontaneously. Things like continuous baby monitoring, which inhibits movement and all that kind of stuff. So, first of all, the report said, yes, it's as safe as a doctor-managed unit in terms of outcomes, but actually it's safer if avoiding these interventions are what you want to do. Not only that, it said for your second baby, home, there's no difference between the outcomes of home and hospital. So, in terms of so-called poor outcomes, which don't include death of the baby, if it's your second baby at home, having had the first baby without any issues, I think the risk of an adverse outcome is 3 in 1,000 for your second baby at home.
So when you say without any issues, would a cesarean can count
as
an issue?
Yeah, it does. Having a previous cesarean section raises the potential for problems at a home birth.
Okay.
I've been at loads of home births at home with a woman that had a previous cesarean section first time round.
Okay.
So it doesn't tell you anything about the individual. That's the nature of research. Certainly randomised controlled trials only ever show correlation between intervention and outcome. It never shows cause and effect.
You say you've been to a lot of births where women had so they're called VBACs, aren't they?
They are. 80% of women that have a cesarean section first time round for what medics call slow progress dystocia is the medical term. Can go on to have a vaginal birth without any problems at all.
So if a woman's had a cesarean and she really wants to have a home birth, then you're saying you've attended a lot of home births.
I have, yeah. And underwater as well, actually.
Really? So if is a woman considering that, then have you got any advice for her?
Yeah, obviously you need to listen very carefully to a medical professional, but understand that he's coming from his or her own preconceived ideas and his own experience of the phenomena. And he's reading the evidence in a certain way.
Okay.
But I'd also say, you know, get in contact with those organisations. I'm straining to think of them. AIMS in the UK would be one. Is it the Association of Improving Midwifery Services? Any organisation that offers information in an unbiased way as possible, so that you can make an informed choice about your choice to give birth at home. Now, in the UK, your choice to give birth at home is sacrosanct. Even if the hospital don't want you to, no one can stop you. You know, I taught a man recently whose wife, Freudian slip. You know what a Freudian slip is, don't you? It's when you say one thing and mean your mother. I mean another. his partner wanted a home birth for twins, a first pregnancy.
How did that go?
That's what she wanted.
Did she have it?
Yeah, so that's what she wanted, and that's what she had. Brilliant. But I'm not blanketly advocating that. I'm just saying that the choice of a woman to pursue that is her choice. Mm. Of course, she got lots of pressure from medical professionals, but got amazing support from the midwifery team. So my advice would be to surround yourself with stories and professionals who are offering you good information, not advice. Advice is useless. Mm. What you need is information that you make your own choice based upon it.
Yeah.
And then make a choice. Of course, bearing in mind that your male partner will almost certainly be, and he was, by the way, will almost certainly be in apoplexy about it, because it will kind of be picking at his safety scab. It will, yeah. And though he'll be doing his best to listen to you and to all the rest of it, that will be a big challenge for him. You see, if his first fear is risk and the fear of death of his loved one and baby, his second fear is having no control. Because, you know, being a man with this intense desire to protect and to solve problems and fix things, to be totally out of control and feeling powerless is probably one of the key factors which is leading to a high raising in the rate of what could only be called postnatal depression in men. And men reporting post-traumatic stress syndrome symptoms.
Are they?
Yeah.
From birth?
Increasing measure, yeah. Not obviously women and men. There's a growing number of men that fall into that category.
Goodness.
And I would say, it's an opinion, so it's not worth much, that fear of seeing... In my book, I write about a group session where we're talking, so it's written like you're listening into a conversation between men. Mm. And one of the guys says, I'm here because the last time I thought she was going to die, and I still sweat and get upset when I feel that sense of powerlessness, like I could do nothing. Mm. And so, you know, fear of them dying, an understanding of risk, and it's followed closely by that paralyzing fear of inadequacy that's it demasculizes, and it's not the best foundation for fatherhood.
So just thinking about the fear of their partner dying, you know, in terms of the risk of that, how risky is childbirth?
Oh, very, well, if you're in the Western world, it's very safe. I mean, going back to the birthplace study, you know, I said 3 out of 1,000 mm. of a woman having her second baby at home. Do you know, the medics and the professionals tell us that if you're having your first baby at home, probably best not to risk it. Now, if I said 3 out of 1,000 women having their second baby at home have what the medics call a poor outcome, how many do you think having their first baby at home out of 1,000? If the doctors are saying it's too risky to try.
I've got no idea.
Right, 3 out of 1,000 for your second, 9 out of 1,000 for your first.
Really?
Yeah. 3 times more risky is the way it will be presented.
But it's still small risk, isn't it?
Small risk.
Yeah.
You've got to be so careful when we talk about percentages, you know. You've got to be really careful when you're reporting on research based on percentages.
Yeah.
I heard a man talking about research he'd done on chickens. And he reported back and he said 33% of the chickens lived, 33% of the chickens died. And he said, in the third one, I just couldn't catch it. Yeah, you know, you really have to look at studies and look at what the vested interest is. All the concerns, by the way, because doctors are not like this because they want to manipulate and control. It's because they feel compassionate and want to do the best for the people they look after. It's just that the filters around the information are very different from a midwife or someone that has a different way of seeing.
Well, I know that the because when I gave birth to my second recently, I was in the high risk category because I was 6 weeks over 40, and therefore, and also I had a very normal pregnancy, and all of everything was fine, blood pressure was fine, and all that kind of stuff. Midwives always give me a good green light. Yeah. But I had that dreaded conversation with the consultant where she was telling me that the risk of delivering a stillborn doubled at my age.
Yeah, but look, yeah,
and the stats are like, well, it went from 0.0001 to 0.0002 or something.
Yeah,
and it's that's still a tiny, tiny risk.
Yeah,
but they talk about it in such a way that makes you feel that it's this massive, massive risk, it wasn't.
No, and at worst, that's manipulation.
Yeah,
at best, it's misplaced compassion. This woman that was going to have twins at home. She went to see, because doctors are hypnotists, they don't realise it, that they're giving post-hypnotic suggestions in the way they talk,
yeah.
Not purposefully. So she goes to see him, and he says to her, I want healthy babies and mother. That is what we want, isn't it? You know, the implication is, you know, all kinds of suggestions. And she looked at him and said, my opinions are... No, she said, I don't want you to feel impotent about this because my opinions are strong, not soft and flaccid, you know. And she was obviously giving him her own post-hypnotic suggestion.
Good girl.
But no, you're bang on in terms of the statistics. And when a man gets to be exposed to this way of looking at the science, he suddenly starts to draw his own conclusions.
So in terms of helping the guy to take fear away, what kind of, you talked about, you know, helping guys to prepare, you know, this playlist idea, which is a lovely idea, and massaging, also lovely idea. Are there any other things that can help the guy to take away that fear so that he's in a good place coming up to the birth?
Yeah, there is. I mean, there's a whole conversation that we'll have about meaning making and about the response in our bodies from an evolutionary point of view. I don't want to use the word design, but the outcome of how we've evolved has been that we're really great at surviving. So the response has to be instinctive. Ideally, we don't have to think about it much. You know, when we were on the plains and we saw a tiger print, you know, if we stopped to wonder whether it was a Bengal or Indian, we got eaten. You know, so they have to work well. But a discussion about how we now generate thoughts and stories that create the same biophysical response in us. So we actually create as much of these hormones in ourselves by thinking ourselves into it.
Okay.
So we have a conversation about the distinction between what happens and the stories we tell. And we explore that from the point of view of our lives today. So we're constantly adding our story to what's happening and confusing our story for truth. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. So we have that conversation and then we also look at, I suppose my hypnobirth friends would call it anchoring, but we also look at mindfulness would be another way of talking about it. We sort of like exercises that focus on diaphragmatic breathing, following the breath, getting into a state of relaxation where we can almost separate those thoughts that are coming up and notice them. It's kind of a way of distinguishing the story, if you like, that we confuse for who we are. We often confuse the story for who we really are. And having an experience of distinguishing that in the first place, which, let's be honest, the vast majority of mankind struggle with that.
Absolutely.
And so do I when I'm in a poor mood.
So you're talking about being mindful where they can sort of create the gap between the trigger and their own emotional response.
There you go. You said it far better than I did. But then practicing that, getting to the point where a bloke is not seeing that like woo-woo BS, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's for me, that's the skill in what I do, is making a connection bloke to bloke.
Yeah.
God, all of this sounds so stereotypical, but you hear where it's coming from, yeah? So getting that connection to the point where they're going, this makes so much sense to me.
So basically, so the guy, in terms of his preparation, you've mentioned some breathing stuff. You've mentioned some, you know, the tape and then the massage and that kind of thing. But then there's also there's validity in them working on, you know, trying to sort of dissipate their own fears in the lead up to birth, so that they can be in that mindful, present place to support their lover, the mum of their future child.
Yeah.
And to be able to connect with her as well. So I think as what a lot of these fears do prevent that connection, where you've got your mind chatter taking over and preventing you from actually being in the moment, which is, I think, probably the best thing you can be in that birthing process, is in the moment.
Yeah, of course. And in fact, there's nowhere else to be, because all of the other stuff that's coming up is coming up in the moment.
Yeah.
Of course, the emphasis from the beginning of our times together is this connection. That he gets to a point where he knows where he has it, and that becomes such an asset in his relationship generally. Honestly, relationships that were struggling, often men feel like the relationship is beginning to turn around. So it's like almost like a side benefit from being involved with the program.
Right.
But one of the things that we talk about is the distinction between what we call sensory-based language or sensory-based internal dialogue and meaning-making. What do I mean? If we were both looking at the same person as they spoke, there would be ways of talking about what we're seeing and hearing and feeling, what we're sensing with our senses, and the meaning that we make about what we're seeing, hearing and feeling. So, for example, I might see someone who I would label that angry.
Mm.
Well, that's already a meaning-making story about what I'm seeing, hearing and feeling. If I go back and just say to myself, well, what am I seeing, hearing and feeling? Ah, their voice is raised above a normal speaking tone. Their forehead appears to be tense. Their eyes are open wider than I'd expect them to be when they were just having a conversation with no energy in it.
Mm.
Did you get the difference?
Yeah.
Now, practicing using sensory-based language to describe what you're seeing, hearing and feeling begins to create a bigger gap between the stimulus and the response. And we do that kind of practice as well.
Yeah. And do you find that guys sort of embrace this kind of work?
I would say, if I was being completely candid, which I'm trying to be more and more candid these days.
Good.
As I get older.
Excellent.
There are issues with teaching this work, largely through getting contact with the women who are pregnant. In the NHS schemes, certainly where I am in Leicester and in the East Midlands, it's not easy to gain access to pregnant women through their midwife unless the hospital contracts you to do it. So there's that kind of challenge. Most of the work I've done has been through women who've said, I want my partner to do it. How can he do that? And they gather together 10 women, other women who want their partners to do it, and then I go to their city and do it in a day.
Right, okay.
And that's not the optimum way, in my opinion. But the ones, you know, the ones that I've done over the years in a day have been just as, well, I don't know about just as impactful. The feedback I get is very, very good from the men. I also do one-to-ones through Skype. So if people can't get to a day workshop, I'll do a program tailored for one person, or I'm exploring Google Hangout and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Because in an ideal world, we'd be doing it week by week over a period of time.
Mm.
So that as you've done the experiments, you've had the experience, you then come back and feedback to the group about it.
Yeah.
And get to talk about what's going on.
Mm.
And that's ideal. But yeah, the response is great. I tell you, I think in the main it's because in their experience they see the difference it's making. primarily in their relationship.
And that's a really good way in, isn't it, to show them that this stuff works, I guess.
Yeah, the only test that matters.
And do you find that because guys, again, just being so generalistic, it's scary, but the guys like to respond to facts, don't they, in science and that kind of stuff. And I just wonder, when you're trying to sort of dissipate the fear in guys or preparing them, whether, you know, how much value the evidence piece plays, but also just a description of what is physiologically happening to the woman that he understands that her body is built for this, and that really there's nothing to fear from that sense. She's very unlikely to die.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that kind of...
Well, we spend a long time on the physiology of the birthing process. Mm. I will deal with all the stuff with men that you would get in a normal NCT class.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, we cover the show, how you know the birthing process has started, pharmaceutical methods of pain in inverted commas relief, non-pharmaceutical methods, TENS machine, water birth, third stage of labour issues, you know, syntometrin or not syntometrin. So they deal with all of that.
Mm.
But the context for it is, these are great things to know. And in the book, there's going to be loads of links to resources away from the book that you can go and get more information. Lots of video so that they can see this stuff.
Mm.
So lots of pre-framing, giving them an experience of all the stuff in a way that kind of begins to relieve their anxiety.
Yeah.
But I say very clearly to them, look, listen long enough for her to raise the issues that she has that are producing anxiety in her without wanting to fix. Listen long enough. And then when she's raised the issues and all the rest of it, then you use this massive resource, because you will know this stuff, or you'll know where to find out more about this stuff.
Mm.
And so it's a different focus. You see, not rushing to fix and display your knowledge early on, but offering her your learning when it's appropriate.
So I'm hoping that we have had some guys tuning into this one today, because it's normally the pregnant mamas that tune in. So if the guy, let's say the pregnant mama listening, and she really wants to get her guy to listen to this, have you got any advice to the pregnant mama listening to persuade her to share this with her man?
Well, I would probably say that her understandings of what's going on for him are crucial. You know, the man that wants to sleep after sex, you know, once you understand the biological phenomena of that, you're not going to make it mean that he's not interested in connecting with you. All he wants to do is come and then go to sleep.
Yeah.
It puts it into a biological context.
Yeah.
You know, the man that doesn't really like shopping, I know this is so stereotypical. You know, when a man sits down, by and large, his thinking process slows down and he begins to regenerate. By and large, when a woman sits down, she starts making a list, either physically or psychologically.
Right.
My girlfriend, that's just the way it works.
Yeah.
You know, so when I got that, I realised that actually, if she's been busy all day and I come in and sit down, I want to recreate, I want to turn off a little bit, I'm not necessarily facilitating her ability to relax by her just seeing me doing that.
Mm.
So just knowing that stuff is really important. And it's equally important for her to realise that. So shopping, for example, for most men, is often a directionless activity when they do it with their partner. They have no idea where they're going or where they're going to end up. So what they do is look for a store with a seat, with a couch in it. You know, so, you know, that happens so often, it's almost folklore. You know? So just being aware of what's going on in him, and it's got nothing to do, actually, beyond the meaning-making, with how your relationship is going.
Mm.
You know, when a man is struggling with direction in his life, when a man is maybe on the verge of redundancy, is under a lot of stress, his testosterone levels are through the floor.
Right.
And his estrogen levels are high, which means that he's listless, tired. He feels directionless and probably has some self-worth issues.
Mm.
And one of the key things that he can do is to do testosterone raising activity.
Okay.
You know, it's just little purposeful actions in his day that raises testosterone. You can look at his diet and his alcohol consumption, all that sort of stuff, and his exercise. I mean, I've lost 5 stone recently.
Wow.
And that came... I've been a lifelong chubby person and loads of diets. And suddenly I realised that at 50, my testosterone-generating capacity is halved from when I was 24. I started to read this stuff and I thought, I've got an adopted son of 6. You know, I want to be as vital and as energetic as long as I can, so I need to do something. So I read the literature. I came to a conclusion that low-carb diet was the best way in order to stimulate my body to be burning fatty acid rather than glucose. And it transformed my way of eating, and 5 stone has come off with very little effort after the first 2 weeks.
Goodness.
But it has the byproduct of raising my testosterone and relieving my stress and all that kind of stuff. Well, I was almost a caricature of a man with low testosterone. You know, any man that's got a waist that's more than 35 inches is producing from that fat estrogen imitating hormone, which is inhibiting his testosterone.
Which means it's more likely to be heading to depression.
Yeah. And down and listless and not having any sense of focus in life. So I think the first start for a woman is if she talks to him about it often because she loves him, with any sense of irritation, he will almost certainly hear that as nagging, and that won't work. It won't work. But having sort of like an understanding of what's going on for him physiologically is probably a place to start, because it will generate compassion.
Yeah.
You know, because of course she loves him and she wants what's best for him, otherwise she wouldn't be with him.
Mm.
You know, and yeah.
Well, thank you for all of this. This has been super, super fascinating, Mark. It really, really
Good.
Has.
Oh, I'm pleased.
And if people want to find out, you've got your book, Birthing for Blokes, that's coming out in September.
Well, the book is called...
Oh, what's it called?
It's called Men,
Yeah.
Love and Birth. And Oh, it sounds like an advert, because it is. It's on Amazon for pre-order, but it gets published on the 2nd of September, and it'll obviously be on Kindle and Audible.com as well.
Fantastic, fantastic. So where can people find you online?
Well, I've got a blog, which is sort of like generic birth type stuff and a bit of spirituality, actually. It's called birthingawareness.com.
Okay.
It's very unedited, and it's very... I write it and put it up. I don't spend much time editing or anything like that, so it's very take it as you find it. There's a Facebook page called Birthing for Blokes,
and that with the number 4?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Thanks for that. Yeah, Birthing for Blokes.
Yeah,
and then on Twitter it's at Birthing for Blokes, and I'm launching a web page towards the end of the year, which will be www.birthingforblokes.com, and that will be a portal as well as a resource for men and same-sex partners that are supporting their lovers through birth. At the moment, none of the pages I've got are primarily for men to come to them.
Right, okay.
But the page I'm launching at the end of the year is primarily for men.
Okay.
And it'll be on the back of the publication of the book, really.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Mark, for joining me today on the Fear Free Childbirth podcast. It's been absolutely fantastic.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to Mark. He was brilliant, wasn't he? Just so interesting and sharing so many really fascinating snippets of information that I think can give real insight for dads and for mums just going into that birthing process. If you're enjoying listening to the Fear Free Childbirth podcast, I really would appreciate 2 minutes of your time leaving a little review on iTunes. The thing with iTunes is the more reviews that you get, the more likely you are to feature higher up the charts. So it just means that more mums will see the show. So that's all it is, really. I'm just trying to play the game. So if you do have a minute to spare, then an iTunes review would just be absolutely fabulous. Now, just a few words about what's coming up here on the show. I've got some really great interviews coming up soon as well, but I'm going to be holding like a Q&A session session, and I'm collecting some questions that I'm getting from listeners at the moment, some really interesting questions that I'm putting to birth professionals like doulas and midwives, and I'm going to have a Q&A show. So if you've got any specific questions around childbirth or pregnancy that you would like answering, then don't hesitate to email me at alexia@fearfreechildbirth.com with your questions, and I will add them to the list so that when I'm speaking to some doulas and some midwives and some other birthing professionals, then I will add your question to the list. So don't forget to do that, because the more questions I have, the better the show will be. And remember, if you've got a question, no matter how silly it might sound, I'm sure there's somebody else with that very question, and they'll be so grateful that you took the time and the effort to email me, because they were thinking about doing it anyway. So don't hesitate to let me know if you've got any questions whatsoever. And also, just finally, before I go, very, very soon, there's going to be some UK podcasting awards. So I might be asking you to give me a wee little vote in the podcast awards coming up soon, but I haven't got any proper details to share with you right now, but that will be coming in the next few weeks. I hope you've enjoyed today's show, and I'll see you next week. Bye for now.
Thank you for tuning in. You've just been listening to Alexia Leachman from the Fear-Free Childbirth Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, she'd really love it if you left a review on iTunes or Stitcher, or shared it with a friend. And don't forget, to get a free chapter from her book, head over to fearfreechildbirth.com to get your copy, as well as finding other episodes in this podcast and more about how Alexia can help you with pregnancy and birth preparation coaching. Until next time.